SF Signal, episode number 18, Adaptations. Why are your favorite science fiction stories so hard to adapt to film and television? And after the cut, John DiNardo and I sit down to chat with Hugo and Nebula Award-winning author Vonda N. McIntyre. The N is very important. Stick around, it's going to be a great show. This is the SF Signal Podcast, episode number 18, as powered by the Functional Nerds. My name is Patrick Hester. I am a writer, a blogger, and an all-around functional nerd. And tonight I'm joined by a panel of folks who bring us SF Signal each and every week. Let's go around and introduce ourselves, folks. First up, Mr. Jeff Patterson.
Hi, Jeff Patterson. I blog at Gravity Lens, which can be found at Vetcom.
Very cool. And we also have, and I'm going to say it correctly tonight, Lisa Pates Spindler.
Thank you. I blog at lisapatespindler.com, and I have, I'm a science fiction novelist and a blogger, and my first book is coming out in the spring of 2011.
Very cool.
Ooh.
We're going to have to read that.
I hope so.
Third up is my partner over at the Functional Nerds, Mr. John Anilio.
Hey, I'm John. I write songs about science fiction and fantasy. You can get my music over at johnanilio.bandcamp.com. I also do a video blog for Wired's Geek Dad blog, and you can follow me at Twitter at twitter.com/johnanilio.
And last but certainly not least, the president of the David Drake Fan Club. That's an in-joke. Mr. Fred Kish.
Hi, this is Fred Kish. I blog at the Lensman's Children. I'm reading a book about calculus right now. I'm taking sixth grade math for the second time, God help me.
Oh my gosh. Why?
Because my daughter's in sixth grade.
just turn her loose. She's on her own.
Yeah, right.
She's even bringing in a paycheck by now, so...
And tonight our topic is adaptations. Why are your favorite science fiction stories so hard to adapt to film and television? And I point to the fact that Peter Jackson brought The Lord of the Rings to movies in three films. Yes, those movies were incredibly long, and the special editions even longer. And he did cut some stuff out, but he playfully said that just because it wasn't in the film didn't mean it didn't actually happen. Tom Bombadil. And he's developing a two-picture adaptation of The Hobbit, which we hope will have more detail and less trimming because it is going to be two films. So why can't someone somewhere do the same thing for Dune or Ender's Game or whatever your favorite science fiction story is? Instead of trimming story down to meet the prerequisite 90-minute 3D PG-13 summer fare, why not do more in-depth two-picture adaptations of something like Dune? And let's take a look at our panel here. John, what are you thinking?
Well, I think there are two things at play here. I think, number one, anytime you have a good science fiction book, I think, you know, it's long. I mean, any book, anytime you try to adapt a book for a movie, you're always going to have to trim it down unless you want like a 10-hour movie or something. And even then it's kind of difficult. They're very different mediums. So I think that's one part of it. And I think the other part of it is just costs so much money to make a movie, and especially like a big budget kind of, you know, science fiction sort of summer movie, that they almost always have to try to make it a PG-13 so they don't cut half their audience out. So I think those are really, they're kind of at odds with each other. And I don't know if you're going to see much of a change in that, just because, you know, you're not going to see a lot of like 6-hour R-rated science fiction movies. It's just, you know, not that practical. So, I mean, I think that's why these adaptations don't often work. And I think, you know, we're lucky that Lord of the Rings worked as well as it did, because, I mean, that could have been a disaster.
It could have been the Beatles.
Yeah.
that was the story. That was an article that came out just like a week and a half ago, was that the Beatles were actively trying to get the rights to the Lord of the Rings to make a Beatles Lord of the Rings, because John Lennon really wanted to play Gollum.
Even you couldn't say no to that.
Oh, yes, we could.
Really? I never heard that. that's crazy.
Yep. And Tolkien himself was the one who said no and stopped it.
Mm.
But that's what it could have been.
Wow. Well, that's pretty out there. And in terms of like books that, you know, I think would just be so hard to do as a movie, the one that comes to mind is a recent book that I read called Here, There, and Everywhere, speaking of the Beatles, by Chris Robertson. The reason a book like that would be so hard to film is it's a kind of a time travel novel, but it's just like all these parallel worlds, and in some worlds there's like lizard people, and it's just so dense that, you know, it's really hard to pull that out in like a linear 90-minute movie. So
gotcha.
So that's my two cents on the topic.
Okay, Lisa, what do you think?
Well, I agree that I think it comes down to length and complexity, that probably shorter stories and novellas might lend themselves better to regular length movies. I think that a full length novel probably lends itself better to a miniseries, which, since you brought up Dune, I guess that means we have to talk about the Dune miniseries. What did everybody think about that?
I didn't think that was that bad. You're talking about the one on the channel formerly known as Sci-Fi.
Yes.
I didn't think it was that bad.
I agree.
I love it completely.
Even the blacklight stuff, I still thought was, you know, I thought it was different. And so it was kind of like, okay, I get that. I understand.
But I think it worked because they had a miniseries length to tell the story. When you talked about Lord of the Rings, I mean, there's vast parts of Lord of the Rings that I think were left out. I mean, the whole idea of the language that Tolkien created, you don't get a sense of any of that from the movies. So you can't reproduce a book in a movie format totally.
Sure. Well, you take the pieces that you can.
Right. But everyone disagrees on usually on what those pieces should be. That's why so many people say, oh, the book was better than the movie.
Yes. There's always something somewhere that something gets left out and people go, oh my God, what are you doing? But you could also look at, you know, I'm dipping into fantasy here. The Sword of Truth, Wizard's First Rule, they tried to make that into a TV show and they ripped it apart and they changed it so far away from the concept of the books and the novels that every week I would sit there and go, what does this have to do with anything? What is this? Where did this come from? So, I mean, sometimes more time isn't necessarily the best thing for them either.
Well, I think if you take a full-length novel and try and make a TV series out of it, it almost works better if you use the novel as a jumping-off point, because the novel probably won't lend itself well to an episodic TV show.
And again, that I think that would depend on the novel, because when you look at something like Wizard's First Rule, I think that was really hard to adapt. It's going to be interesting to see how HBO fares with George R.R. Martin. You would think that something as episodic as the Dresden Files would lend itself really well to television, because at its heart, it's a detective story. And while that show was okay, that didn't do very well either. I think that
I enjoyed it, but I guess, yeah, it didn't get the ratings that it needed to get.
Right. And again, you had people going, oh my God, there's no Beetle. You can't have Dresden without the Beetle.
Actually, yeah. The Beetle does show up in the pilot episode.
He's driving a Jeep that's booted.
I know, but it's up on a rack.
Oh, gotcha. Well, that leads me.
There are reasons they didn't use the Beetle.
Well, that leads me. That leads me to you, Fred.
Well, I think you got two problems. The first is that you need a production team that is very strong and very true to the vision of the book, because that's the only way you're going to get the fans that agree that it works. But on the other hand, you got to look at the book. I mean, every time I hear that they're going to make a movie out of Foundation by Asimov, I cringe, because most of those books are just two people talking for a long length of time. There's very little action.
Yeah.
That's going to make a very, very bad movie. But it works as a book for me because I'm reading it. It's playing inside the theater of my mind. I mean, I think, you know, we mentioned Lord of the Rings. I think another one that's a good example is 2001. Even though the book didn't come out kind of first, it was kind of being done in parallel. Both Clark and Kubrick worked very well together, and Kubrick had a very strong personality and could, you know, ram down what he wanted to do in the studio. whereas a lot of production teams, well, you know, the studio is run by a bunch of people who don't share that vision, so they may not, they may force changes upon you that you don't want in order to make it more quote-unquote popular. Maybe that's what happened with Terry Goodkind.
So. It's possible. Jeff, you have some Hollywood background. What are you thinking?
God. Okay, assorted notes. Number one, and I say the following with the fact that with the exception of Watchmen, I have not watched a new movie since the Powerpuff Girls movie came out.
Ooh.
I am Mojo Jojo.
Couple things. Number one, this is not a new phenomenon. Two of the most beloved movies in Hollywood history, Wizard of Oz and Gone with the Wind, are horrible adaptations of the source material.
And considered, you know, classics and timeless, and people just love them to death.
You said it right on the nose. Point number two that goes through my mind, there's not enough bleach in the world to cleanse my eyes after seeing that Green Lantern trailer.
it's pretty scary. That's one of my favorites, and I'm sitting on the edge of my seat. I'm clutching the armrest. I'm going, oh, come on.
And the thing about it is that the DC animated movie that came out was actually pretty good.
Yes.
That was very good.
And I think the same animators are painting his costume on him. So it seems, because it looked terrible.
Something that went up on SF Signal today was the Cowboys and Aliens trailer.
Mm-hmm.
This was a comic many years ago, and I do remember that when the comic came out, it was put out by a very short-lived publishing company. And it was criticized because the business model of this comics publisher, as a lot of different publishers had as a business model at the time, was they were trying to create properties specifically to get bought and turned into movies. So I'm rather curious how that's going to work.
There was a really bad B movie, I thought, that was made based on that, Cowboys and Aliens. Wasn't it like Full Moon or something?
I honestly do not know.
That's going to bug me.
I've always been of the opinion that if they ever make a movie of Canticle for Leibowitz, it will feature a bunch of kung fu monks fighting off post-apocalyptic mutants trying to protect their sacred scroll. To go back to the Dune miniseries real quick, I personally really liked it for a couple reasons. Number one, they really tried to hit most of the storylines of the book. And number two, the thing to keep in mind, and this is what amazed me while watching it when it was first on, it was television. This was not a movie. This was basically a TV miniseries, and the sheer production value, yeah, it's aged a little bit, but when it first came out, my God, it was pretty amazing to watch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Part of this, a big chunk of this also falls on Hollywood and the Hollywood mentality. I remember, forget who it was, somebody who had worked on the first Swamp Thing movie, which, you know, all going to hold judgment on. The script was first presented, the Hollywood people, and keep in mind, we're talking 20 years ago. We're not talking the modern, movie making by committee. The criticism that was made against the script was that nobody would understand that it was a comic book movie unless it was a person who turned into Swamp Thing every time something bad happened. Okay. And to see how that has occurred in Hollywood, look at movies like The Shadow and The Phantom, where because they've hired, you know, actors and paid them salaries, we can't keep their faces hidden for the entire third act of the movie. And
running
around with their faces showing, which kind of defeats the purpose.
Think about Spider-Man.
Running around without his scarf is just ridiculous.
Spider-Man.
Precisely, yes.
Spider-Man 1.
Yeah.
Mask gets ripped off. Spider-Man 2. Mask gets ripped off. Spider-Man 3. Mask gets ripped off. Batman. Mask comes off. Batman 2. He rips the mask off.
Inversely, look at V for Vendetta, where his mask never came off.
Yes. Yes.
So,
I agree wholeheartedly with you. They're also talking about the Avengers might become a huge, big ego fest.
Well, I've been very much enjoying the new cartoon. It's not quite up to the level of a lot of the DC stuff, but the new cartoon that's out has been a pretty pitch-perfect adaptation of, you know, the storyline, keeping it pretty modern, given the fact that the story that they've been doing was basically written in the 60s.
I thought they were doing Ultimates.
The two Ultimates movies were horrible. They were just plain horrible.
I've seen the show that you're talking about. I'm not a fan.
Well, I liked what he called the kid show they do too, the Superhero Squad. I think that's an adorable show, and I hate the cutification of all things, you know, genre to start with. But I think that's a pretty good show because they put a lot of thought into it, and they've got some decent stories in it. So,
Now, John and Elio, you came up with a story that you thought was just going to be impossible to adapt. Is there something that you think is just sacred, and you hope that they never attempt to adapt?
I can't think of anything that I think is sacred that they should never. I think just some things work and don't. Because I mean, I think a lot of people would say that Lord of the Rings should have never been adapted, and like, look how well that came out. You know, I mean, if anything, I like the movies more than the books at this point. One that I think really I could definitely see getting made is. It's, so to totally not answer your question by answering the opposite, the one that I really think could be made is Old Man's War, Scalzi's book. I think that could really be crafted into quite a good movie that I think would have appeal to a pretty broad range of audience, because you have the whole thing of an older, you know, man. I mean, I think it's a concept that I think is accessible to even non-science fiction fans. And you can I say
something to that real quick? Because the one that was going through my mind was Ender's Game.
Okay.
And both of those share the same thing. They're military science fiction. And if you look at the bulk of science fiction adaptations, they are either A, military SF, or B, they tend to slide into the horror genre a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they realize that, yeah, military SF, the hook is already there. It's something that's understandable by the non-SF audience, and hence they do it.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you talk about Old Man's War, he's got some connections with the Stargate crew. So, you know, he just needs to pitch that to Joseph Malozzi, and then they get Richard Dean Anderson to play the old man before he gets changed. And before you know it, you've got Old Man's War, you know, and he's up there saying, oh, for crying out loud.
Hmm.
Yeah, but on the other hand, they'll pitch it to sci-fi, and the man Squeedo will somehow be worked into it. So.
Well, Off-Man Chronicles.
Yeah, I think Old Man's War can be made, like, I'm talking like not a made-for-TV. Like, I think that could be made into like a real big-budget deal. I feel like that can be adapted pretty nicely, you know, if they so chose. And I think it could work.
Lisa?
Well, I mean, talking about so many military novels that were, made into movies, something that doesn't quite go along with that would be Blade Runner, Minority Report, Total Recall, a lot of the Philip K. Dick.
Philip K. Dick is a separate subgenre unto himself with Hollywood.
How about Starship Troopers?
Yes, I was going to bring that up too.
Yeah, I love that movie.
And iRobot.
You know what? It's funny because I went and I saw Starship Troopers without having known that there was even a book associated with it. And I thought it was a great summer movie. I was like, wow, this is a really cool movie. You know, and then you kind of go and you talk to people who are a little bit more well-read. They're going, are you insane? Are you stupid? Do you not understand how badly they screwed that movie up?
I saw Starship Troopers three times.
If they had at least put power armor into it, it would have at least made up for the bad storyline.
I want to say something about that, because this is one of those arguments that I hear quite a bit. And I reread the book shortly after the movie came out. And if you view the movie as satire, okay, and go back and read the book, it's almost like a great big in-joke for fans of the book, okay? And I agree, the power armor would have been nice. I find myself justifying and rationalizing a lot of movies like this, okay? Somebody mentioned iRobot, okay? iRobot is a horrible iRobot movie. But there used to be a comic in the 70s called Magnus Robot Fighter. And it's a perfect adaptation of Magnus Robot Fighter. Go ahead.
iRobot the movie, the studio had another story with a different name by a different author, and they also owned the rights to iRobot. So right. They took that other story and filed off some serial numbers and put iRobot on top of it.
That's what happens. If you ever watch the Dolph Lundgren Masters of the Universe movie and pretend you're watching a Jack Kirby New Gods movie, it's actually bearable. And I feel the same way about, to drag up another Will Smith masterpiece, Wild Wild West. If that however, next time that movie is on, watch it. If that had not been a Wild Wild West movie, if somebody had said, we're just going to go ahead and make a big steampunk Western, it takes a lot of the sting out of it.
I agree. I think you can have a bad adaptation and still have a good movie, a fun, good movie. It might not be true to the book, but it doesn't mean that the movie on its own is terrible, necessarily.
Right. True, but Jeff's killing me here.
Hey, I have to survive this crap somehow, okay? I sit through it and I go, oh, you've got to be kidding me. This is ridiculous. Who okayed this?
Okay, so I think we need to wrap this up because if Jeff pulls any more of these movies out of my past that I probably loved when I was a kid, I'm going to barf.
I'm your worst nightmare.
Jeff, I think that you and I could talk movies for hours.
Well, they'd have to be pre-2002.
So. I can do that. Okay. I can do that. You'd be surprised.
Mm-hmm.
All right, well, I want to thank everybody for coming on tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we will see you guys next week. Have your own thoughts on the subject? Tell us what they are. Call us at our voicemail line, 720-277-9082. And tonight we are joined by Nebula and Hugo Award-winning novelist Vonda McIntyre. Did I pronounce that correctly?
Absolutely.
Awesome.
I do use my middle initial.
Oh, that's right. You do. I'm sorry. Vonda N.
That's okay. My mom was Vonda McIntyre, so...
I didn't know
it
that.
It was a little... Yeah.
Very cool. And
that's why someone with such a weird name uses her middle initial, is that I'm not the only one.
That would make sense. I also have John DiNardo with me here tonight.
Hello, hello.
Hey, John.
How's it going?
That's fine.
And you have a very illustrious career. You've written, oh my gosh, something like 18 novels and dozens of short stories. I'm a little starstruck and I don't know where to begin.
I think you're inflating my resume just a little bit. I'm kind of slow, but I've been around for a long time, so. Well, there are a bunch of novels.
There are, and let's start with what we discussed earlier, the Bookview Cafe.
Okay.
Tell us a little bit about that.
It's an author's co-op of published writers who have managed to keep our hands on our electronic rights, which, let me tell you, is not all that easy in this day and age. And we're in the process of putting our backlists into ebook form so that people can get them.
Okay.
And so far, it's chugging along pretty nicely.
Very cool. And how many authors are involved in that now?
We've got about 30 right now.
Oh, wow. And that's been going around, let's see, I'm looking at the website here, since March of 2008.
I think we started... I believe we're coming up on our second anniversary, because we actually started in November of 2008. We started talking about it earlier than that, and it takes a while to get something that complicated off the ground.
Mm-hmm.
But I believe that our anniversary is the 15th of November.
And are the titles only available through BookView, or can you also get them like through Amazon or Borders on their e-readers?
Many of our members have work up in the Kindle store and the other online distributors. You can, if you buy stuff from BookView Cafe, you will find that it will work on most of your dedicated e-readers.
You provide multiple formats, right?
Yeah, we do several different formats, several of which are readable on the, say, the Kindle, for example.
Gotcha.
And if you have any trouble, email me and I'll do my best to fix it, because I'm one of the people who creates those files for the co-op.
Hey, Vonda, you mentioned that e-book rights are hard for writers to obtain. Why is that?
Because the publishers want to keep them. So they put it in the contract, and they say, this is a deal breaker. You sign the contract with those rights in it, or there's no contract. Unfortunately, well, it's getting better now, but up until a couple of years ago, basically they would grab the e-rights and then not do anything with them. So it was kind of frustrating for people because, you know, you wanted people to be able to get your book in the format that they want to read it in. And the publishers just weren't up to speed on making that happen.
Do you think that's changing nowadays?
It's changing. It's changing so fast it's hard to keep up with.
What's interesting about that is talking about them, you know, essentially demanding those rights and then not doing anything with them. That's almost like they didn't want to do something with them. They wanted to force people to buy the paper books.
It's hard to know exactly what. I'm sure it was different for each publishing company and for each individual in each publishing company. And you would hear all sorts of things like, "Oh, I don't want to have my book in electronic form because it'll get pirated." And you just look at somebody who says that and you laugh at them, because pirates don't pirate from electronic copies. They scan they rip books apart and scan them and put them up on the web in generally pretty well munged versions. There's a version of Mist and Grass and Sand that's been going around the internet since basically before there was an internet.
Oh my gosh.
And it's completely, people used to send it around by email. It's completely munged. You know, it's just a horrible copy. The pirates couldn't even be bothered to steal the correct text off my website. It was up on my website for years, and they were still sending around this completely munged copy of it. And, you know, I would much rather people read it at my website where the text is correct than from, you know, outer Mongolia or wherever it was being hosted. And I just don't get it. I don't get it.
Well, it's definitely a hot topic for a lot of authors. You know, John and I were recently at World Fantasy, and there was a lot of folks that, you know, as you're walking by, you could hear the conversations of folks talking about e-rights. And there was one person who said something along the lines of, you know, you have to demand your e-rights. You have to. You know, they're going to try and tell you that it's a deal breaker, but it's not. And you just have to demand those.
It depends on the contract. It depends on the publishing company. It depends on how much, how powerful the writer is. If you're J.K. Rowling, you can demand anything you want. If you're Vonda McIntyre, you can't.
One of the interesting things that has come about from doing this podcast and the other podcast that I'm on is talking to a lot of the different authors. And some of the older authors are enjoying the e-reader market because, you know, they're getting the rights back to some of their books, some of their earlier books, and they're just turning around themselves and they're publishing them, you know, through Amazon or through something like BookView Cafe. And, you know, it's getting these books that haven't been in print for some, in some cases, decades, you know, back out in the public eye.
Right.
And that's wonderful.
And they're being very successful about it too. I mean, Dream Snake got caught up in two different publishing meltdowns. So it was out of print for a long time. And it's hard to get paper copies of it these days, but it's on book. It's at BookView Cafe in electronic form, so people can get it.
And for the benefit of the two listeners that don't know what that is, why don't you tell them what Dream Snake is?
Well, Dream Snake is the book that, if anybody has heard of me, that's why they've heard of me. It was my second novel. It it got a lot of attention. It was actually kind of controversial when it first came out, because it dealt with a lot of things that science fiction hadn't traditionally dealt with. And it won the Hugo, it won the Nebula, it won the Locus Award, and it won the Pacific Northwest Booksellers Award. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of nice.
Yeah, definitely. And so that's now available at Bookview Cafe. Do you have any other books that have been out of print that are now available through Bookview?
Yeah, the Starfarer series is out, both in individual volumes and in an omnibus edition. And Moon and Sun is available in electronic form, and Superluminal, which is... it's actually not hard to come by, because you can buy the print copy from me, but it's hard. People don't know that, so you know it's hard to find. They have to know to go looking for it, but it's there in electronic form, and the books are also available in online serial versions, which are for free.
I was just gonna say, it's interesting that you said people can buy Superluminal directly from you.
Yeah, years and years ago, I started something called Basement Full of Books, which was an email list of books that you could get directly from their authors. Oftentimes, when your book is published, after it's been out for a while, the publisher decides to remainder it because it's not selling fast enough to keep it in the warehouse. And at that point, you can often buy some copies of it.
Hmm.
So I bought some copies of it, and then I thought, gosh, I have all these copies of it. How am I going to sell it? And I started this email list of... me and other authors who had their books available by mail, and that's kind of fun, because you know you can get them signed, you can get them inscribed, and after a while it got too big for email, and Jeffrey Dwight, who owns sff.net, gave it a home. So if you go to sff.net, you'll see a link to Basement Full of Books, and there's a page about it on my website. So
nice.
People can get the hardcover, you know, signed hardcovers. And,
wow.
Yeah.
Using the internet to sell books. That's great. Do you think that the internet has become a kind of a required tool for authors to have, or for authors to use to promote themselves?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, which is kind of tough on people like me, who are kind of introverts.
I think most authors are introverts, to be honest with you.
I think that's true. But, you know, some aren't. Some are just really extroverts, and they love to get out and, you know, schmooze. It's fun for a certain amount of time, but it's exhausting. I find it really exhausting. I have to be on my best behavior and, you know, restrain my potty mouth. And
not necessarily. I think I know some authors who could teach you a thing or two.
I'm sure they could. Yep.
It's awesome that, to be honest with you, that you've embraced the internet as much as you have. I mean, the email list is just awesome. And then, you know, following something like that up with Bookview Cafe, which gives these authors, you know, another forum to publish their books and make money. And I'm assuming for them it's a much better split.
It is. Absolutely. And it also gives us the I want to say one thing, which is I'm not the boss of Bookview Cafe. I'm a toiler in the fields of keeping it going. The project manager is Sarah Zettel, who is absolutely awesome in keeping the thing going. And Sue Lang and Maya Bonoff and Patty Nagel and, you know, a whole bunch, Brenda Clow and a whole lot of other people just work their butts off on it. So it's not just me.
And,
but one
and
thing it...
Oh, I'm go sorry, ahead. Go ahead.
And you know, Ursula Le Guin is in it, which is amazing. It's just wonderful. She's started blogging a little bit. She was inspired by Jose Saramago, who started blogging when he was like 90 years old. she's got three or four essays on Bookview Cafe blog that are just wonderful. And there's one coming out next week called The Links, which just made me cry when I read it. So people should look forward to that.
Yeah, I was going to say it's not just a place to buy ebooks, but you know, the blog alone is worth its weight in gold. So you got, I mean, all the contributors of Bookview Cafe are out there writing interesting posts, and you know, every day. So it's really a good stop.
Right, and I kind of put myself off track there. I was going to tell you that one of the things that the outfit lets us do is put together anthologies. So we've got several different anthologies. We've got a fantasy anthology called Dragon Boy and the Warrior Women, and a science fiction anthology called Rocket Boy and the Geek Girls, and an original anthology of steampunk stories called The Shadow Conspiracy, and there's another there's a follow-up anthology coming up in a couple of months, and a book called... oh, I hate it when this happens. Anyway, a book of writing advice called Brewing Fine Fiction, which has been pretty successful. And the one that I'm proudest of and most sorry that we had to do is called Breaking Waves, and it's a benefit anthology for a little tiny Gulf of Mexico relief organization that is helping people recover from the oil spill. And the cool thing about doing something like this is that everything about it was contributed. Everything was donated. The stories, the editing, the layout, the disk space for, you know, everything was donated, which means that it's not one of these things where, oh, the profits of 6 cents on the dollar will go to the organization. All the money that comes in, except for the bite that PayPal takes to do the financial transaction, goes to the charity. And we're really you know, I think it's an extraordinary anthology. I think Phil Radford and Tiffany Trent did an amazing job of editing it, and there's some really wonderful stuff in it. It's got Le Guin and Sarah Monette and James Salas, and I'm leaving out a half, you know, 90% of the table of contents is on the website, and it's really an extraordinary anthology, and I'm proud to be part of it, and also heartbroken that it was something that we felt the necessity to do. My family used to winter on Sanibel Island in the Gulf of Mexico, and the place was just paradise. And over the decades, seeing what we've done to this amazing natural resource, not just the oil spill, but the dead zones, and just pouring crap into the Gulf of Mexico for decade after decade after decade, it's just heartbreaking.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know... not to go off on a weird tangent, but I know Katrina, the New Orleans, still hasn't fully recovered from all the stuff that happened there. So who knows how long it's going to take for the Gulf?
Exactly, and you know, and people who say, "Oh, that couldn't have been predicted," they're just wrong. It's been predicted that sort of thing would happen for decades. People who knew what they were talking about would look at the situation and go, well, the next really big hurricane that comes through here is going to do this and this and this and this, and that's exactly what happened. Now, they didn't predict that the human response to helping the people who were stuck in it would be so completely fouled up, but they did predict what would happen when a great big storm ran into that into the Mississippi Delta.
Yep. Not to take away from that, and this is going to sound like a kind of a weird segue. I did want to just briefly say, you know, how does it feel to be the person who gave Sulu his first name?
Oh, it just tickled me pink. I didn't know until sometime afterwards that there had actually been quite a little conundrum about whether that should be allowed or not. I mean, I just wrote the book. I wrote the book when I was a pup and Star Trek came on, I started writing a screenplay for it during the first commercial break. Now, I was like 17 years old, I had never written or published anything. I'd never seen anything like this on television before. And it, I just thought it was amazing. And I never managed to sell a screenplay. I did manage to get one as far as Gene Roddenberry's desk, and then the show was canceled.
Hmm. That's still not bad.
And so when David Hartwell asked me if I'd like to write a Star Trek novel, what, 10, 20 years later, I said, that would be lots of fun. And it was lots of fun. All the deadline was kind of dire. So I'm writing along and I'm writing along, and I realize that I'm writing this love scene between two characters, one of whom does not only has a last name. And I just couldn't deal with the idea of a love scene where the characters called each other by their surname. So I made up a name. I made up a name for him. And then apparently a Paramount, somebody at Paramount said, oh, you can't do that. Oh, blah, 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 blah. And finally, somebody had the brilliant idea of asking Gene and George what they thought about it. And they both said, well, sounds good to me. So it got to stay in the book. And so that was really fun to do.
Was that awesome? Was that the entropy effect?
Yeah. I thought George Takei ought to get more to do in Star Trek. He was a wonderful character.
He still is a wonderful character.
His character was a wonderful character, and you know, I only know him to say hello to, but he seems like a really terrific person.
Oh, absolutely. Now, I did have kind of a question about that. So that was one of the very first of the pocketbooks.
It was the first original pocketbook Star Trek novel. It was not the first original Star Trek novel, because a different publishing company had the license
right
before pocketbooks had it. But it was the first original novel from the pocketbook Star Trek line.
I read something somewhere, or someone told me something at one point. I used to know Nana Graysmick, who did a lot of the early Star Trek cons in the 70s. I don't remember if this came from her or if I read this somewhere, but somewhere, sometime along the way, it came to me that the authors who wrote the first novels kind of kept a continuity in the Star Trek novels that Paramount decided they didn't like.
My books came so early on in that process that I really don't know anything about that. I think that came out that when I wrote mine, they trusted me to treat the characters with respect and to not go completely off the deep end in terms of going outside the universe that had been set up in the original series. And after I was not doing it anymore, I think the rules got a lot more stringent, but I really don't know anything about it because I just wasn't involved in that part of the process.
Okay. I was just curious. I had read something somewhere, because I knew that there had actually been like some characters that crossed over from book to book, or, you know, from one book to another, they, you know, what happened to the characters actually still affected them. And I remember, I think it was Paramount, you know, just basically said, we don't want that. You know, we don't want you guys keeping a continuity like that.
Yeah, so. that was all after my time. So you'd have to talk to somebody who was actually writing in that part of the series to talk to you about that.
Gotcha. Now, you did not only original novels, you also did the novelizations of several of the movies.
Right.
How did that go?
It was fun in that it was fun. It was exhausting in that the deadlines were just brutal. They were just brutal. Oh, my God. For the first one, The Wrath of Khan, they sent me the screenplay, but they left off the last 10 pages because it was supposed to be a big secret that Mr. Spock died. Now, never mind that people were going around going, oh, my God, Mr. Spock died. Let's storm the Paramount gates and make them not let Mr. Spock die. So everybody knew that Mr. Spock died, but I was supposed to pretend that I didn't know it because I didn't have the last 10 pages of the script. I'm writing along, and get the end of it, and the book is due the next week, and I still don't have the last 10 pages of the script. So I call up Paramount, and I say, hi, I'm Vonda, and I'm doing this book, and I need the last 10 pages of the script. And I'm talking to this vice president, and he tells me what happens in the last 10 pages of the script. And I think, oh, fine, now I can stop pretending that I don't know what happens to the last 10 pages of the script. And I say, okay, now Now, I can, from what you've told me, I can write the last scene of the novel. But you got to realize that if I don't have the last 10 pages of the script, I can't make the dialogue sound like it is from the movie, because I don't have it. And there's this long pause on the other end of the line. He says, oh, I get it. You need the last 10 pages of the script so that you can write 25 pages of gobbledygook. And I go, could you pardon me for just a moment? And I got my notebook out and I wrote, get the last 10 pages of the script so that you can write 25 pages of gobbledygook. Because it was too good a line to forget, you know? And I came back on the phone and I said, well, yes, exactly. I need the last 10 pages of the script. So finally I got the last 10 pages of the script and I could write the last section of the book. But, you know, I was looking at that line and thinking, that was an interesting thing for him to say to me.
have you seen the remake they did last year? Or
I did see it, yes.
What'd you think?
I was surprised how much I enjoyed it. I think Zachary Quinto is just cute as a bug. I thought he channeled, his inner Spock just marvelously. There's always things you can say, oh, I'd have done it that way or I'd have done it this way. But basically, I quite enjoyed it.
I thought they really nicely tread the line between pleasing old fans and entertaining new ones.
Yeah, that must have been really quite a high wire tap dance act.
I bet.
You know, there's two people I wouldn't necessarily want to be, and one is J.J. Abrams having to do that. The other is Brandon Sanderson trying to finish Robert Jordan's work. I think those two guys are incredibly brave.
That would be tough.
Yes,
it is true.
I kind of sort of hijacked the last 10 minutes of this interview because I am such a huge Star Trek fan.
Oh,
I read both of the books, The Entropy Effect and Enterprise, and loved them. I can't say that I read the novelizations of the movies, because I don't think I was even aware of them, which isn't anything on you. It's just me just me being stupid.
Well, that's, you're not required to read everything in the known universe. It was fun to write the movie novelizations because you can't just transcribe a screenplay and end up with a novel. It's too short. So I got to put in a lot of backstory and subplots and character interactions that they just didn't have time to put into the movie. Some of them were in the screenplay and either were never filmed or ended up on the cutting room floor because they just didn't have time. But most of it I made up, and that was lots of fun.
Well, and sure, you got to do three of the most fun ones, Star Trek II, Star Trek III, and Star Trek IV.
Right.
You know, I can imagine you probably laughing quite a bit writing Star Trek IV, because that was such a funny movie.
Yeah.
Well, I think that we should probably wrap this up. Why don't you tell people where they can find you on the internet?
VondaNMcIntyre.com.
And they can find books there. They can find links to stuff. They can also find you on bookviewcafe.com.
Right.
Do you do any social media? Are you on Twitter or Facebook or anything like that?
I have both a Twitter account and a Facebook account. I'm always Vonda and McIntyre. You know,
keeping it simple.
Right. So, you know, I figure if I'm going to do it, people ought to be able to find me.
Well, we appreciate you coming on with us tonight.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you.